This is another in a series of oral history interviews being conducted by the University Archives and Special Collections Unit, Illinois Institute of Technology. Today we're in the Donnelly Hall of Galvin Library, the 15th of November, 2019. Today's guest is Richard Laurent, practicing architect, instructor at Columbia College in the Design and Illustration Department, and a 1969 graduate of the Institute of Design. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Slight correction. I'm not an architect.
I'm sorry.
Practicing artist.
But artist. Okay. I must have architect
and
the brain.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the correction. Absolutely.
It's a pleasure to be here today. Right, thank you.
Yeah. Yes, we're eager to hear your story, and from prior conversation, we know that you're prepared to converse with us a bit. So yes, where were you born? What sort of background did you come from? What was the point in your earliest years that you came to decide, you know, what your future career would be, and then how did that truly develop?
I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and it was kind of a one-horse town in those days, and I started out wanting to be an animator for Walt Disney. That was the first thing that I wanted to do. And I was very interested in the comics in the newspaper. So my brother and I would open the funny papers, and they had a guy on the radio who was reading the funnies to everybody. And that was the first time I ever thought, gee, I'd really like to do this. And then I kind of put it away and went about my business. So
that
revisited
stuck in your mind.
Yeah, it stuck in my mind.
Okay, good. Before we get any further, I stumbled in two issues moving forward in terms of introducing everybody. I'm University Archivist Mindy Pugh, and I am co-interviewing with Adam Strome, Director of University Archives and Special Collections. So let me always make sure that that's in there.
Yeah.
Okay, what were the popular cartoons of the time when you were growing up?
Well, the standards were classic comics like Dick Tracy and Dagwood and Blondie. There was a cartoon strip called Gordo. It was a former Disney animator who was drawing for the Denver Post. And I used to read Pogo. He was also a former Disney animator, too. I seem to be drawn to this style of drawing or something. So we didn't have things like Charles Schulz yet. Mm-hmm. Denver was a little bit of a little provincial in that sense, in terms of the Sunday funnies.
All right. Okay. Old stodgy ones like Our Boarding House and whatnot. And so,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. So what made you decide to come to IIT?
IIT.
Yeah.
I didn't have a sense of anything having to do with design. And a rep from IIT came to the school, and my art teacher, who really championed me, I was working in printmaking in high school. She said, "I think I want to introduce this guy to you. It's a design department in Chicago. It's a design program, and I'm sure you're not aware of how this works or anything, but I think you're the right person for this, and I'm going to try to get the two of you together." Hmm. And gets you a scholarship to ID.
Okay.
And that was that.
Wow.
What
do you think about the way that you worked made this teacher think that way? Think that you would be a good fit?
Well, I was a dedicated artist by the time I was in high school. So she put me in a back room the last 2 years, and I had all of my electives bundled into one afternoon workshop that was conducted by me. By myself. So I made prints, everyone else had theirs, and I became I was the president of the art club and things like that. So it was all heading towards some kind of art, but I didn't know what kind. I didn't really have any understanding of design at that point.
Old-fashioned press.
Yeah, I was doing monoprints, and I got into the Scholastic Art Awards, and I did pretty well there, and it seemed like this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to draw and paint. That's all I knew.
Mm-hmm.
That was blind ambition. So when this opportunity presented itself, I was a little bit unknowing about where this was going to take me. But I knew it was going to take me out of Denver. And I was also looking for a way to go to a bigger city. And I had been thinking about New York when I was a senior, and had some sort of fantasy of being a beatnik in New York and being an artist and all kinds of things like that. So this was, we had been to Chicago before on car trips when I was growing up, so I kind of knew something about Chicago. I didn't know anything about the Institute of Design.
Okay. Were your family supportive of your coming, or were they like, why are you leaving the state, you know?
My mother, until she passed away, was still complaining that I left home. Mm-hmm. But they were happy for me to get a scholarship.
Okay. All right.
I think that was their
main, so they were generally
their
supportive.
Main concern was, they're paying for this, he's going, we know where he's going. So
yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That, it worked out in that sense.
Okay. So you arrived in the fall of 65?
I did. I was in Fowler Hall with a group. They placed me in the wrong dormitory, so I was in a dormitory with engineering students. All the IDs were in Farhol, and I immediately became friends with people that I would know the rest of my life, but they weren't design students.
Hmm.
So that was kind of odd, but it came to serve me well when I was working on senior projects here in ID.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did the school feel like when you arrived in the mid-60s?
It was kind of exotic in the sense that it was on the near south side, and there was this huge city just down the road, just a train ride down the hill. And it was a little bit daunting, too. It seemed very austere in terms of architecture and everything. Mm-hmm. So I immediately began trying to look for some identification with, you know, what I understood to be comfort, maybe, or home, or so I found this piano in Herman Hall, and I would go over there and play the
we've
piano.
We've seen photos, like Baby Grant. We've seen
it was a Baby Grant. I used to go over there every night and just play by myself. I mean, I was not a great musician, but I enjoyed playing jazz. So that was sort of something that brought a sense of home.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to make friends and on campus, and you know, we did the things that freshmen do. I won't go into those.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a car so that you could get around? Or you used
second year, I had a car.
Okay,
right. I had an old Plymouth Valiant, which I drove to Denver, blew out the manifold because I drove straight through nonstop. My father was angry,
mm-hmm.
but I did have transportation. And then later, when I was dating in college, the writer's door, the driver's door froze. So I remember going on dates where I would, being the gentleman, I would open the car door for the lady and then crawl over her to get to the to the steering wheel.
I have to ask about the interest in jazz, because obviously this, back in the 20s and 30s, was Chicago's great jazz district. Was there any of that left that you were able to attend back in the mid-60s?
I had a friend, and not from IIT, but we would go to jazz showcase shows all the time.
Okay.
And at one point they were located in, they're much closer now to where I live. They're two blocks from where I live, so it's a wonderful opportunity. But
was that downtown back in the 60s in the Loop?
They were in various places. Yeah, okay. They were in one of the hotels for a while, too.
Hmm. Okay.
And so being someone who admittedly didn't know much about design, or, you know, kind of understand what you were getting yourself into, what was it like walking into ID in 65?
Well, it was initially the scope of walking into Crown Hall for the first week, which was just overwhelming in terms of the sense of space. I had never experienced a building like that before. And I landed a job right off the bat, mounting photographs for Mies van der Rohe. So that was my first experience with the architecture department, which was a pretty big one. The problem was, I didn't know who he was the first time I met him.
Hmm.
And he came down. He was a very very charming to me. He said something very brief to me, like, "Yes, they're straight. They're mounted straight," and he walked out. So that was my introduction to design in Chicago.
And not a bad one.
Then I did the research, and it was a very formidable thing. I was more in awe when I saw him in the future. So that was my introduction to ID. I really didn't know what the curriculum was going to be about, and it was totally alien to me at the beginning, because we had this regimen freshman year, the foundation year, where we were building things and working in the shop. And I wasn't particularly good in shop. And we had a guy by the name of Ray Pearson who taught the foundation shop class. And we were terrified of him. He was an expert on Shaker furniture and was a real craftsman in his own right. We reconnoitered the class, and we said, "How are we going to pass this class? We're going to flunk out of ID. We won't be here in a year." And ironically, a number of students left after the first year. I don't think they failed the classes, but it was so daunting for them, the regimen that we had. And I think about that often now when I teach and I get freshman classes. I'm probably not as strict as the instructors were at that time, but I kind of missed that. I mean, it instilled sort of a process from the very beginning for working in design. And that would come back to help me and also hurt me later in my career. Spoiler alert.
turned well. You had enough self-confidence to continue on past your doubts at any rate.
Yeah.
Or enough stodginess or whatnot. So
yes.
How often did you run into Jay Doblin?
I kind of got to know Jay because one of my design jobs was I worked for McMurray Knight, which was an adjunct to the design planning group, who were right upstairs, one floor. So Jay was always coming down. We were on the same floor with Richard Latham, Tyler and Jensen, and they were very formidable product design people too. So Jay was coming down to chat with them often, and Richard Latham actually came back to my cubicle one time and saw a painting I had done on my cubicle wall. It was my only sense of place and property, I guess, and he said, "I want to buy that." He didn't in the long run because we had a dispute over the price, but it was I guess kind of an honor to have that happen. And I saw Jay later too, once in a while I would see him in social situations, and I think he was already ill at that point.
Okay.
So he was a formidable guy too. He used to come into our freshman design class, visual design class. And I'll never forget this. He showed everyone how to paint a straight line with a brush. I mean, that's, now that I look back, it's kind of rudimentary, but I kind of take the same approach with my painting students. He came in and he said, "Now this is how you draw a straight line." It was sort of, in a funny way, it was kind of putting us down, but we didn't understand that at that time. We needed discipline at that level. So I was always in awe of Jay. I thought he was a really, really bright guy, and he kind of drove the whole organization. It was interesting knowing him, at least a little bit. So
you tended to see him downtown more as opposed to on campus, or it was...
Well, I would see him in reference to the workplace, but that just brings to mind my very first experience with Jay, which was his very first project, which was the elegance problem. And later he would give us lectures, many lectures, on elegance in terms of product design. So we were all scrambling around trying to buy materials. You're supposed to purchase some materials and assemble an elegant thing. And then he came down to critique. And I went out and I bought plexiglass and I learned how to use it. And I built this smoke plexiglass box. And I had this fish line and three ping pong balls. For some reason, this was my idea of elegance. And I was talking with our friends recently who came in for the reunion here. And they were all going out and buying very expensive wine goblets and things. And mm-hmm. when he came down, he more or less lauded those people who, oh, that's a great cup. Mm-hmm. And he got to mine. During the night, one of the ping pong balls had fallen off. So here's this. Here are a couple of balls.
You can't repair it.
Hanging. Uh-huh. And he just sort of did a Donald Trump on me, basically. Mm-hmm. And I was so embarrassed. I thought, I will never make this mistake again. Mm-hmm. But it was I've never forgotten that moment. But that was my first experience with the design world and someone of that stature.
It's interesting that it's a part of an assignment to produce elegance.
Yes.
The
smart students went out and bought elegance, and I was trying to construct it, and I had no idea what that meant at mm-hmm. that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I still struggle with that.
So. Do you think you kind of, how long do you think it took for you to kind of get your feet under yourself in terms of design in general and ID in particular?
Oh, it took me at least into my junior year. I was just sort of bouncing off of the walls, trying to figure out how to live in Chicago, how to exist with my new compatriots who were dorm people,
mm-hmm.
And trying to understand. I actually considered for a brief moment transferring to the photography department because that was a more concrete kind of aesthetic where even though we would go in, I'm trying to remember some of the photography teachers we had, and I can't. Well, Joe Jackno was one of them, of course. And I realized my aesthetic was kind of off compared to what was happening at ID. And that happened for a lot of my peers, too. We were often discussing this. We formed these little cliques, sort of self-help groups. It was like study groups, but instead of study, we were just talking about what is design? What does this mean? What does it mean for our careers? So, of course, we were looking to the future, too. You know, what were we going to do when we graduated? So.
And do you think ID was a place at the time that allowed for different aesthetic approaches or ideas? Or were you expected to kind of like toe the aesthetic line?
It's a very interesting question. We were expected to toe the line, and I felt that upon graduation that we were literally disciples of Bauhaus design, mm-hmm. going out into the world to save the world, in a sense. And that was okay at that time. I had a few incidents where that it didn't play out that way. I had a class with Chad Taylor. He was our visual design daily instructor, I guess. And I played hooky. I was doing paintings for the Union Board concerts at Herman Hall. Mm-hmm. So every month they'd have Chad and Jeremy or somebody come in. And I would do a painting for the easel outside the...
Oh, wow.
So I was busy finishing my project for them because it was due. And Chad Taylor knocked on my door. He came over to the dorm and he said, "Yeah, I didn't think you were somebody who you know just ducked class." He said, "So I thought I'd come over." And he said, "You're painting on an easel. What is this?" He said, "Are you interested in illustration?" And I said, "Well, I guess." And he said, "Well, the Chicago Graphic Artists Guild or artists society is having this luncheon, and we're having a very famous illustrator come in, who will be coming in, and why don't you go with me? So it was a great break for me.
Hmm.
And the illustrator was Bernie Fuchs, and he was I had been seeing his work in a lot of magazines. I was starting to pay attention to what the illustration market was, because I wanted to draw. So he took me to this luncheon, and I was very impressed with the illustrator. I think because he showed up in a Ferrari, and everyone was buzzing about that. And I thought, well, that's an elegant object. So I said, wow, could I be an illustrator? So I had this sort of dual purpose after that, which was a designer who illustrates, basically.
I just have to ask here.
Yes.
It's a little segue, and then we'll get back to your specific career. But 1968 in Chicago, did you go downtown and participate in the demonstrations, or
you kept
yourself clear of it?
No. I was very active. In fact, we went to the convention riot, in quotes, and I went with one of my instructors.
Okay.
Carl Reger was teaching the print publishing class at that time. And I got to know Carl pretty well. Myself and a few other students would go out to lunch with him, and he'd put us in the car and take us down to Hyde Park, and that was a special experience. We loved Carl. He was a wonderful guy. He was, you know, he was one of the progenitors of Chicago Magazine, the art director, first art director. So we were just crazy about Carl. So he also took four of us and invited us up to his studio one time. He sensed that we actually told him we were trying to start a business together, the four of us. These were four of my class, three of my classmates. And he said, well, you come up to my place near DePaul, and we'll have coffee in the morning at my place, and I'll show you my studio, and I'll tell you the way it is. And he gave us the come to Jesus talk about working in the business. However, getting back to what your question about the 60s, we took a camera crew out to Grant Park, and we were standing there, and we were filming. Carl was probably 50 yards away with some film people, and somebody threw a trash can lid, like a big frisbee, right into the police squadron that was coming down the street. And the next thing we knew, it was bedlam. The police were literally attacking us from the Art Institute direction, and they were coming, this sounds like war, doesn't it? And they were coming at us with their billy clubs and mace, and for some strange reason, everyone was running south, and I just stepped through the line. I was between police officers, and I just stepped through the line, and suddenly I'm standing there all by myself.
Okay. And there's all the police had passed you.
They had passed me, their backs were to me, they're beating I saw Carl go down. And they maced him, and he had some medical issues that resulted from that, and some of the other crew members did too. So that was kind of a trigger evening for me. I think I became more political at that point, but I also began staying away from these dangerous situations too. I had been up to Lincoln Park, you know, listening to the Chicago 7 and so on. I was pretty active. I'd been at the armory when they tear gassed everyone. They shot tear gas into the trees, and it bounced back right into the reserves, and they all went running. It was just a comedy of errors, the whole thing. But I realized at that point, and then I think the final rally I went to, there was a guy standing next to me in Grant Park next to the wall, and he pulled out a pistol. And he was a high school student, and he said, I'm going to shoot a cop tonight. And I said to myself, I think I'm really in harm's way here.
Right.
I think it's time to kind of pull back. And And it's fine. It's okay to draw about this. I think that's when I had that realization that I could sort of enter into the debate without having to be out on the front line getting beaten up.
So. Yeah. I've seen footage of it. It was remarkable. So something about your going back to your calm inner core.
Yes.
Again, I'm going to presume this is accurate to say about you, that interesting how that would be recognized, and the violence would literally just sort of pass around you.
It was an odd moment in my life, and now that I think back about it, I was just lucky, basically. Mm-hmm. Years later, my studio was at the Fine Arts Building, and the owner of the building and I were talking one day, and he said, "You know, I was in the reserves or the National Guard, and I was out in Grant Park." Mm-hmm. He said, "And there was a line, and all these students were walking up and putting roses in the barrels of our M16, and I said, "I was there. I was on the other side. I wasn't putting roses in, but I was documenting that event with my camera." So we had a beer over that later in life.
Did you start? Well, you've got a lot of things happening in your career, but did you start some preliminary political cartooning at that point, or drawing, or was it just the photography and whatnot?
Well, I was doing graphic design, so I was trying to think like a designer who illustrates. So I really wasn't doing anything related to cartooning at that point.
Yeah, okay.
I was in the sure. mode to follow this course that had been set by ID, and I was just trying to get a foothold in the business at that point. So
sure.
I wasn't showing any cartoonish work at all.
Okay. I just had to ask, if you're in Chicago in 68,
I wish I had
interesting
been.
To hear that you went downtown.
Had I been a political cartoonist, I would have been in heaven.
Yeah,
but
would have been a good time for it.
Yeah.
And so, you're on campus also for the Kent State protests.
Yes.
Were you? Okay, because you graduated in 69 and the protests were
Oh, no, that was 70.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, no, yes, you're right.
Unless you came back. But.
No, you're right. You are correct. I'm a little fuzzy on that now.
What was the kind of vibe on the campus that you felt in terms of either social or political activism, or even people worrying much about anything outside of, their finals?
Oh, it was a very, very... I won't say they were informed, but there were a lot of activists, especially in ID. I mean, it was, ID was motivated by all kinds of social issues. Mm-hmm. They were very tuned into that. I'm not sure that the rest of campus was doing this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They were a little bit straight-laced about these things.
Yeah.
My engineering friends were pretty straight about everything, but I was going to these rallies, and I was trying to stay up to date on what was going on. One of the things that did happen, the assassination of Martin Luther King, I was in the dorm for that, and I remember they had a lockdown on campus. We had to turn all of our lights out that night because people were shooting rifles from the projects, and they were afraid we were going to get shot. And I essentially lost a very dear friend, not to bullets, but he was one of my classmates, an African American. And we had been very close friends before that, and he just started to pull away.
It was interesting.
I ran into him years later when I was working for the American Bar Association. He was on staff there. And we were always going to get together, and unfortunately he passed away before we could. But I always think about Jerry and the impact he had on my life. About freshman year, he told me to read James Baldwin's Another Country.
Mm-hmm.
And that was literally the first novel I read at IIT, and it changed my life. I began to look around and see the neighborhood and everything that was happening.
Right. Oh, no. That had a huge impact in the mid to later 60s.
Absolutely.
You mentioned a few minutes ago the sort of Bauhaus ideology, and which was... do for society and attempt to move society forward, and How formally was that taught, or was that just literally kind of in the atmosphere?
That's a good question too. Now that I think back, it was a very formal presentation.
Okay, all right. Who was articulating that the most?
Well, Jay Doblin was very he was intellectually precocious, so he kind of came and went, and he was a very free thinker. So a lot of what he brought to the table wasn't about the Bauhaus.
Okay.
It was about the history of art. That's one of the things that drew me to him. Mm-hmm. He would give these lectures about the Beaux-Arts, mm-hmm. and how that had been an influence on Western, you know, art, you know, strands, and how the Bauhaus sort of went against a lot of those premises, and mm-hmm. that it wasn't about, you know, this was something I had to grapple with. It wasn't about painting and drawing. It was about other things, ergonomically solving human problems and things. So we kind of got a big picture of what we were supposed to do as designers. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just about going out and getting a job mm-hmm. and doing a pretty annual report cover or something.
This is interesting because, well, those of us who didn't live through that, weren't here, weren't even in that profession, oftentimes here, is that so many of the faculty and students who were here in the mid-50s when Doblin came were feeling that he pulled things too much in a sort of a kind of a design direction that was not referenced to the history of art or societal or cultural issues. You're refuting that.
Well, maybe I was reading through what he did. I think I saw a bigger picture. I mean, he gave lectures that were very negative on certain art movements, modern art movements.
Okay. Mm.
And I chuckle now when I think about that, because a lot of the art processes of the 50s and 60s sort of dovetailed, that were involved with the architectural school, dovetailed with modern and postmodern practices in the fine arts. You walk into any IIT architect's apartment, and you'll see abstract painting on the wall, and so on. And that was something that I initially, when I was an abstract painter when I was 12 years old, and I didn't fit into the regimen that was painting and drawing in Denver, Colorado. That was one of the reasons why I wanted to leave. And when I got here, I realized that there was a dovetail between that and the design process, mm-hmm. which really appealed to me. Mm-hmm. And I thought very seriously. I hadn't made a decision at that point about where I was going with my fine art career. Mm-hmm. So it was all like fodder for me. I was just drinking it all in.
Yeah. So it sounds like it was a nurturing, for the most part, nurturing environment for you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I still have that Bauhaus sensibility, even though I don't practice that. I mean, my friends and colleagues will often rib me about what I'm doing as a designer, a graduate from ID, mm-hmm. how different it is, because I'm an imagist painter. And mm-hmm. and so on. So
yeah, well, some of it is irreducibly just who you are.
Yeah.
And so, you graduate in '69, and what was your first foray out into the world of design as a Bauhaus disciple?
Well, initially, I was interviewing with designers who were hopefully in line with this, but mm-hmm. they kept informing me that that I was an Institute of Design graduate, you're one of the guys who is into the philosophy of design. You don't really have any practice. You haven't had any experience in just what we do in the studio every day. Keyline and paste up. That was the first wall that I had to scale, which was your entry-level job was some design work and a lot of production work.
Yeah.
And in those days, there was no digital.
Mm-hmm.
So everything was done on a drawing board with a mat knife and rubber cement and so on. Typesetting, everything. So I was looking for a place where I could sort of gain these skills and also work. My first job actually was with a packaging design firm, Dickens Design. And they were very notable. They had designed and built their own building on Grand Street. It was a father and son who started the place. Highly successful. They had Pepsi and Sprite and all various automotive clients. They had big clients. So I was basically relegated to the photo reference room. And I was sort of, my initial job was to document what the other designers were doing. They had a mock-up of an in-store, like shelf grocery store downstairs in the basement, because they design a lot of food products. And in terms of the automotive products, they had built a custom garage with, I think they had 6 or 8 cars. They had a souped-up van, and they had a Lamborghini and all kinds. I got to drive the Lamborghini to some of the clients. My first actual project as lead designer was the BorgWarner Hot Performance Parts project. So that was a time, again, that was, you know, early 70s, and there was the automotive people, Dodge and Ford and everybody, were making these cars that were really, you know, now they're collector items. So I was sent out to collect a sample of every alternator product on the market. That was my first assignment, to go to every parts jobber in the city and buy an example. And then they set all these things up, and we started working with the competition. This was really a design marketing firm. The design firms didn't call themselves that until about 4 or 5 years later. But they began to combine those elements. And the one thing we didn't have in terms of background from ID was marketing. There was no marketing input. So we were working on this philosophical level, as I mentioned before. So when I got to Dickens, they kind of gave me a hard time about that. And there were some very seasoned product designers who worked there, who had been there for 20, 25 years. And they had a different background entirely. So I saw another form of design being done. In fact, they had one hand letterer, which is, you know, that job just disappeared.
Yeah.
He hand lettered. We had a Japanese gum company that was a big client. And they were competing with Wrigley's at that point. They were going to infiltrate the American market. So we went out to the airport. We rented a limousine. We put Japanese flags. The owner of this company was sort of like Trump, too. Mm-hmm. Sort of like Donald Trump. So we picked up the head of the company with this. And we did some other things, too. I think one of the designers drove, and they rented a limousine driver's suit for him. It was all a circus, and this was something I hadn't been taught in design school. So the hand letterer actually would letter the net weight type, 6-point type, on the sides of 250 gum mock-ups that we were going to present. That's how things were done at that time. So I was impressed by the amount of detail that went into presentations. I was sent out once to buy every bourbon on the market. We were doing a bourbon company. We designed the label and also the bottle, and we also redesigned Linko bleach too. I worked on that project, and it was interesting because we designed a beautiful. This was an ID kind of, I can't take credit for the input on this personally, but it was a cube that stacked, and it was a beautiful design solution to Linko bleach. They could stack twice the number of bottles, Because the old bottle, you can picture in your mind, was just generic.
Whatever. Yeah.
And they put this on the market, and people wouldn't buy the product because they didn't recognize it. We had the same problem with a project for India. We were going to redesign a cosmetic bottle for this cosmetic factory, and the bottles were hand-blown. And the country at that time was largely illiterate, so women walking into the shops did not recognize the new bottle shape. And didn't fly. So I began to see another side to the design process that was oriented in a different way.
Right. And so you went, in a rather short time, you went from someone who was kind of going in a more fine arts direction, you know, as a high schooler, and then a short, although I'm sure it didn't seem short at the time, but a short, you know, maybe six, 7 years later, you're seeing things that you had an input in on supermarket shelves.
Yes. And that was kind of exciting to see something you had worked on in every Target in America. Mm-hmm. And even though it was a very tiny thing. And I realized there was sort of a parallel between that and the original thing I wanted to do, which was work as an animator for Disney. And be part of, you know, a cog in this giant machine that is producing animated films. So I guess one of the reasons I kept pressing to bring illustration into my design work was because I wanted to do things that were a little bit more individual. Mm-hmm. And that became kind of a mantra for me. And I went to work when you can fast forward. I went to the military. I was drafted, served 2 years. When I got out, I couldn't get a job in Chicago because of the nature of this beast, which was the military was very unpopular with the public. And I would go somewhere for an interview in Chicago, and they would. I tried agencies, design firms, and they were really just, you know, off the record, kind of on their high horse. And they would say, oh, you were in the military. Oh, okay, sorry.
Interesting, even though that had nothing to do with who you were.
So I went back to Denver, and I applied for an agency job there, and I got a different rejection. It was, well, we like your work, but we're hiring people who don't live in Chicago. Because, and I hadn't told them that I grew up in Denver. That was my hometown. So I came back, and I found a design firm, Bissinger Verwolf Design, and John Bissinger was an ID graduate, and they hired me. Verwolf was a veteran, so he hired me, and they put me on Bank Marketing Magazine. That was my first print project of note. I had done some little, you know, logos and things along the way, and after a few months, they made me the art director, and I'm looking at the art in the magazine and thinking, wow, I could do better than this. So I started doing illustration for the key articles in the magazine in addition to laying the magazine out. And again, this was a very open period in terms of publishing and clients accepting this sort of politically charged work. Things stemming from the 60s and all the things that the older creative crowd wanted to participate in, and they were trying to appear to look cool to their employees. So the first thing I ever did for this magazine, I realize now, was just really kind of radical for an illustration. For a magazine like that, it wasn't oriented to the business market at all, but it just was that period of time when things were more acceptable. So I really enjoyed that job, but I felt I had to move closer to the mainstream and get back to what I had been trained to do.
Yeah. And, quick question, just to nail down that the military time, were you in like 71, 72 in the military, or?
I was drafted in 70. I had just gotten married.
Okay.
Married for 3 weeks, and they drafted me. And I got an early out the beginning of 72.
Okay.
Right. Richard Nixon was cutting the troops.
Yeah, right. Were you sent over, or were you in? I was kept in the States.
I was at Tanzanute.
Oh, you were at Tanzanute. Okay.
I never was in combat, but I came very close. Yeah. Here's an interesting side story.
Sure. Yes.
I graduated from basic training, and I was a draftee. So the rumor was, well, you're all going to Vietnam, so get your gear together. So we went to get our orders. It was a huge airplane hangar. There were thousands of people and like 20 lines. And I'm going through the line waiting to get my orders. And this young guy, he had my stuff. He said, oh, you've got a college degree from IIT. I'm supposed to give you orders for Fort Gordon, Georgia, but I see when you took your physical, the requirement is you have to be 5'9" to train for MP school, which is something I didn't want anyway. But it was it was another form of combat, but it wasn't, you know. So sadly, I'm only 5'8". He said, well, I can't give you these orders. I'm sorry. Hmm. Technically, I'm supposed to give you advanced training for combat. Hmm. But he said, I'm going to say something here. I'm a design graduate, too. And I thought, oh, my Lord, this is, you know, how fate
yeah, how things
happens to right. to weigh in. And I said, tell me what's on your mind. And he said, well, we need someone at a duty station in Washington right now that has a major or minor in photography. And I said, I have a minor in photography. He said, swear to me that you don't have to go to advanced training, and I will write you orders to go straight to your duty station, which is a top secret lab.
Wow.
Outside the Pentagon. And I said, yes, yes sir, yes sir, yes sir. So that happened, and it probably saved my life. And I don't know who that was. I will never know. But the odds of two designers meeting in that context, what are the odds?
But you did end up at Tanzanute later?
I had to finish my duty. I had just gotten to Tanzanute, and they called everybody back. Yeah, so
that's Saigon's major airport.
Yeah, that's right? The major airport.
I lived through part of that. 72, there was one last big Viet Cong offensive.
Yeah, yes.
Did they hit down towards Saigon? Or
I left right before that.
Okay.
Just before that, yeah. Because they knew they were withdrawing all the troops, the other side. So that's when they hit.
Okay.
So and there was, I was talking to somebody else the other day, and they said there were some rocket attacks on Tanzanute. I didn't experience any of those myself.
Okay. So. Another thing that you were lucky to avoid it.
It's like, I wasn't meant to be in the military. Yeah. I just wasn't meant to be there. So.
So you return and you begin to do, you're doing art design and illustration for, you know, the Spanking magazine.
Yeah.
And when did you move on over to Britannica?
Well, I had moved from Bissinger Verwulf over to McMurray Knight, where I met Jay and had that reconstituted that relationship. It wasn't exactly a friendship, but it was a relationship. And then in 1975, I had the chance to interview for a job at Britannica, the educational corporation, and the lovely design person, who was also an ID graduate, who sat next to me at McMurray Knight, said, I know the design director at Britannica, Paul McNair, and he's, I think you should go over and talk to him. I think he would really fit there. So I did, and I got the job, and I was designing educational materials, multimedia. And that was the subject of my senior thesis at ID. So it was like, can't believe this. This is an opportunity to actually practice what I studied for a year, my capstone project. So that worked out really well. I learned a lot about corporate politics. It was a family-owned company. Mm-hmm. William Benton had owned an ad agency, Benton and Bowles, very highly successful. He had bought the rights to Muzak, which is a term going way back, where there was music in all the elevators and all the business buildings. He owned that and became a multimillionaire. So he bought Britannica from the University of Chicago. And that's how Britannica Educational Corporation came to be. The board was made up of University of Chicago people, professors, and so on. So it was highly venerated when I arrived. Charles Van Doren I would see in the elevator every day, who would later have that scandal with the $64,000 question. Mm-hmm. But he was on the board of Britannica.
So you're able to stay in Chicago for that? Or
Yeah. They were located at the river and Michigan Avenue. So I worked there for 18 years, and I worked my way up. Paul McNear left, and I became the design director, and then I became the creative director. They folded in the film department, film animation department. I always wanted to do animation, so this is where it came back. Mm-hmm. And there were two Latvian cameramen with an Oxberry just sitting there with nothing to do. And I got this brainstorm. Let's rekindle the animation program here at Britannica. We have all the resources. So we tapped Columbia College for young talent who were studying animation. And they would come up at night. They had a whole department. And it was sort of my Disney fantasy, which we brought to life. And they were working on film titles, sequences for educational films was a very broad category. It was all kinds of things. It was Inside the Atom and, humanities and all sorts of things. Short story showcase, short animated films, Aesop's Fables. And so we had this, there was a lot of material to work with. And it was an interesting experience, but it took me away from the mainstream design business, too. I kind of lost track of what was happening in the design community here in Chicago because I was involved with educational publishing. And that had a whole different set of characters, different cast of characters.
And so did you eventually decide, I'm doing all of these things that I wanted to do when I was younger, but I kind of need to reconnect?
Yeah, there was that need to sort of complete the gestalt of my life, basically. And by the time I was working at Britannica, I could take a project and illustrate it. We had children's booklets and things that went into these programs, and I'd give out four of them, and I'd do the fifth. And then it was really a great experience. And then I was illustrating for... that's how I got back into animation. I found myself... animation directing these Aesop fable films that were about 4-minute films. And we were really stretched in terms of the staff to do this. We didn't have I had an art department with 5 people. And then I had the Columbia College animators who were actually working on separate films. So we tried to keep those separate. And but every once in a while we'd get them together, and we were working on some pretty big sequences for films. So that's where I met my eventual my second wife, actually. She was a producer there. So
I'm curious. Of course, the famous monogram and whatnot. Of course, growing up in the 60s and 70s, as I did, there was so much of that geared toward public schools and whatnot.
It was.
Did that mix change during your time there, or was that still always preponderant?
No, I brought the ID sensibility as best that I could to Britannica, and we began redesigning the identity. I was working with the marketing department, and a lot of good corporate design projects came out of that. And my first big multimedia project was very, very close in its concept to the things that I had been doing at ID, and it could easily dovetail into you know, the ID design archival things. It was very, you know, it was a departure from the old-fashioned educational materials. Mm-hmm. It had a different veneer to it. And I was really keen on doing that at that time, really bringing my ID background into this.
Okay.
It wasn't always met with favor by the management, but generally they were accepting.
Well, I'd imagine it could be quite lucrative.
Yeah, yeah. It was a good time because we did what started out as a prototype package became a whole program that lasted grades 1 through 6. Mm-hmm. So we kept, you know, evolving this into spin-off programs and things. And I began to see where if politically things had stayed constant, I could have stayed at the company for a whole career.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah, what was the political context you're referring to? Well, just within the particular ownership or management culture? Or?
Well, there was this this ownership, you know, private ownership process. Louise Benton owned the company, and she was married to the president, so they basically were the last word on anything. Mm-hmm. We would go into management screenings on Friday afternoons, and they would have what I call the Carnival wagon, which is a wagon with cocktails, mm-hmm. and all the marketing VPs and everybody, sales VPs, would come in and mm-hmm. review the films that we were working on, mm-hmm. and have a cocktail party. Mm-hmm. And they knew nothing about film, so it was like we would be standing in the projection room listening to the commentary and like tearing our hair out, basically.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
How do we work around this to get a really good product out there? So uh-huh, uh-huh. that was the challenge of Britannica Films. So
eventually you had just read, we were ready to move on from that.
Well, there were a lot of political upheavals, and yeah. There was a shadow government, shall we call it.
Okay.
Britannica was sold to another company, and they ended up bringing in their management. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty much the end of the run for all of us.
Okay.
I had gone through another a layoff about 8 years before that too,
mm-hmm.
and there were a lot of you know, the recession was in 1998 there was a recession.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There was one 10 years later. So every time a recession would hit, there would be big layoffs in the publishing business.
Yeah.
So the people would scramble and go to other places, and I began doing some moonlighting projects for World Book at that time.
Oh, okay.
Not as a designer, I didn't want to muddy that water, but I was doing some illustration projects.
Mm, okay.
And so that gave me the impetus. Honestly, there was a point at which I had two jobs. I had my day job, and then I had my illustration business. And that was, I realized it was going to be a decision point for me,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and to become a working illustrator, I was going to have to make that jump.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And it happened. When did it happen?
It happened in 1991.
Okay. All right.
So I already had my clients and everything. So I just kept going.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's hard to believe how much it's almost 30 years now.
I know. It's crazy. So other things happened after that. In a nutshell, I was working as an illustrator for magazines. I was doing all the American Bar Association magazines. I did some national magazines like Fortune, and I worked for newspapers like the Washington Post doing freelance work. And
mm-hmm.
that's where I began to think, well, I was starting to do work with a little bit more humor, and I started kind of edging toward this whole idea of doing political cartooning.
Mm-hmm.
So my drawing skills were up to par. I had to develop a new style to do these, the political cartoons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this was the early 70s, the late 70s. For about a decade, it was the second golden age of illustration.
Oh, sure.
I've done a lot of teaching on this subject,
going,
you know, talking about the the famous illustrators and so on. But this was a very lucrative time to be an illustrator, and people were buying illustration. This is before photography started to eclipse everything again.
Oh yeah, right.
So there was a lot of work actually, and so that was part of the impetus to go on my own too. And I was in 2007 I was offered the chance to try out for the Sun-Times editorial cartoonist slot, and I did that and I got the job. So that threw me into this other reality.
Yeah.
So
did you get an office in that classic low-rise building, Sun-Times building there?
No,
on the river?
They had already moved over to the river.
They had, okay.
And they were reducing the size of everything. So people like me would have been in a cubicle. In fact, this was part of the package that I negotiated for myself, was that I would not work there. And it was a little touch and go. She said, well, you have to work on site. And I said, I live right across the loop. I can almost see your building. So I can be to you in 20 minutes. So there were some of the classic columnists had window offices and so on, but I didn't want to be there. I saw one sad young man sitting there one night, and I in his little cubicle, and I said, "Oh, what do you do for the Sun-Times?" He said, "Oh, I design the front page." I'm the page designer for the front page of the Sun-Times. He was about 24 years old. So that was one of the perks I had with that job. Now, on the downside, I had I worked 6 days a week drawing cartoons. And they had to be, the assignment came at 11 every day after the editorial meeting, and I had to have roughs to them by 2 and then the finish by 4. And there was no way to miss a deadline. It was just you're holding up the presses were the words given to me on my first day at work.
All right. How much latitude did you have in terms of subject matter? Are they saying, okay, we need a certain percentage of local, certain percentage of national?
Well, I thought I had more latitude than I probably did, but generally every day's piece was driven by the cover story.
Okay.
So if it was Mayor Daley, I'd do a local piece.
Okay.
And during the 2008 election, Obama's election, it was all about politics. So it was national politics. And we were doing cartoons. We were also doing drawings of Obama and John McCain.
Yeah.
In fact, I was starting to work at Columbia College at that point, and I thought, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to have a real problem here because I'm drawing 6 days a week. Every day is pretty much, you know, the whole day. So, and although I enjoyed it, I got in, you know, the adrenaline rush was something. And my only fear was that I was going to trip coming downstairs to send my work out, you know, through the internet. And I'd trip and break an ankle or something, but it was great fun. But until I realized that I probably couldn't do that. The money was really good too. So what I did was I took my page editor to lunch. And I've never done this before. I've never sold someone else. I've never pitched anybody. But I had a very good friend who was a wonderful illustrator also, and I said, "I've got a proposition for you. What if I drew 3 days a week and this fellow drew the other 3 days?" And then there was a New York cartoonist who drew on Sundays. So she said, "Well, I don't know. This is..." I said, "No, talk to him. I'll show you his portfolio. He's a real veteran." And he was also a good friend too. So we had the best time, you know, talking about the jobs we were doing. And it was a little competitive, so the level of our drawing went up, and we had a great time. It was fun. But it also allowed me to start teaching at Columbia College too. So, because I was sort of placing bets in my head about which job would end first and which one would have longevity for me. Obviously, Columbia College was the winner in that case, because 2 years into my thing at Sun Times, they went Chapter 11. So
okay, all right.
And they just came through, and I walked into the newsroom one night, mm-hmm. and there was nobody in there.
Oh, wow.
All the monitors were on. Hmm. There was somebody sweeping the floor. That would have made a good cartoon.
Yeah. So you then took responsibility for your own distributing, or?
I connected with a Dutch political cartoon site. Mm-hmm. By now, everything was online. So, mm-hmm. And I'm still working with them.
Okay.
And they publish my work as they see fit, basically.
Okay. Right.
They have an editorial board, mm-hmm. and it's a paying job. It was a little hard figuring how to get paid from this group. So, you know, it's a little bit harder now to find venues for mm-hmm. this. Publishing my book was a good thing. It opened a lot of doors for me. I've done a lot of speaking in different venues on this subject. We did a keynote at the Illinois Art Educators Association last year, my wife and I. So that was fun. It was fun. I got to talk about political cartoons. So I also teach cartooning now at Columbia College, because by doing that, they said, oh, you're qualified to do this, so here's a new venue for you. So,
excellent.
You know.
Well, and I also wanted to give you the chance, mm-hmm. I'm trying to be mindful of the time, but I also wanted to give you the chance if you wanted to talk about the work that you do with your wife.
Surely. Cheryl Jefferson and I operate this social justice art initiative. That's how we named it. Mm-hmm. It's titled The Art of Influence, Breaking Criminal Traditions. And it's based on a TED Talk she did in 2013 at IIT. Mm-hmm. And it was, she had done a lot of reading on this subject, and we had decided that there were various injustices throughout the world. This brings back the social justice issue that, you know, mm-hmm. as a political cartoonist, I've addressed.
Right.
And we're also addressing this maybe in a more serious way. Mm-hmm. And we put together, I didn't want to pee in my own pool. I didn't want to curate my own shows. So, and we wanted this to be a group show. So we appointed an independent curator, Chuck Ganick, who is also one of the design professors at Joliet Junior College right now. And he selects the work for the show. It's all professional artists, and it's we have no religion or culture bashing. The artists mm-hmm. Handle any subjects they see fit to handle. We don't give them subjects to deal with. I paint for the show too.
Okay.
And we've done this since 2013. So mm-hmm. we're in our 13th venue. Our last venue was at Penn Technical College, mm-hmm. which is a division of Penn State. Mm-hmm. So we mounted the show there and in one of their major galleries. These are large gallery spaces. We have about 60 works of art. Mm-hmm. And it's been our charge in the last 4 or 5 years to find new venues. Our very first venue was IIT, mm-hmm. Kent College of Law. We used their new building, the second floor. Dean Krent, I believe, it passed away recently. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. Sorry, yeah.
He gave us the green light, mm-hmm. and we produced this show. And it's been a real life-changing experience for us.
Oh, yeah. Production, a whole different sort of production.
Yeah.
And live, yeah.
And I'm painting, you know, I have to have a different mindset for this type of work. Mm-hmm. It's not illustration. It's not political cartooning. It's serious painting. So, and we're getting a lot of good feedback where we go. There are a lot of, our mission initially was to go to law schools around the country, mm-hmm. so that lawyers in training would see this other side of a different area that they might end up practicing, especially when they return to their home countries.
Yeah.
And that's still our mission statement, is to reach young lawyers.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. we are not afraid to take on the social justice label, which it's become such a lightning rod for
it
people
has.
On the other side.
Yeah, about 2 years ago, Cheryl turned to me and said, you know, I think it's becoming a popular subject.
She is not
at
wrong.
Least that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, mm-hmm. you know, when we do these interviews, we sometimes have these discussions, and I think today's a great example, where you kind of hit on these different ideas or interests, and, you know, it's just amazing to kind of watch the way things circle back around, and, you know, this thing that flashes up as an interest or a moment of inspiration 20 years later, you find yourself sitting down and saying, ah, yes, here's this thing. I can draw this line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, we're working on a book project now for one of our friends who is, he was a CIO at USG Corporation, and he's written these books on the how these bridges and circles work in corporate management specifically. And it's interesting to read that and say, hey, we've been doing this. You know, this is we're in the process of building these bridges right now. We may not have known that when we started out. Mm. It was just trying to do something honorable, I think. Mm-hmm. And that takes me back to the ID too. I think the purpose and the process from the beginning in my design training was to do something like this. I didn't know how I would express it, but that's the mission.
Yeah. Wow.
Great.
Great.
Well, I think we're kind of winding towards the end here, but one thing that Mindy and I always like to do is to give people the chance. Is there anything that we didn't ask about or that you wanted to talk about to make sure we include here?
No, I think you've been very patient.
Oh, no.
Thank you so much.
These are always interesting discussions. They require no patience.
Thank you.
Part.
Yeah, not at all. It's a very great highlight of what we do.
I appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for taking part, and it was a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you.